KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The Trump administration is diverging from decades of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Russia, saying it now sees opportunity to partner with the Kremlin.
European leaders are alarmed. The U.S.'s top diplomat is trying to quietly reassure them.
For Friday, February 21st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Also this hour, Hong Kong's main opposition party has announced it's dissolving.
It struggled to survive following a crackdown by Beijing.
We'll hear how U.S. funding cuts are threatening other dissident groups.
Plus, we'll hear from people in Greenland about how they feel about President Trump's desire to acquire their homeland for the United States.
And later this hour, 2 weeks after it started sending Venezuelan migrants to a detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the U.S. government has deported them.
What's it tell us about Guantanamo's role in Trump's deportation campaign?
Those stories and others after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is shaking up the leadership of the Pentagon, today firing the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Air Force General C.Q. Brown Jr., the second black chair of the Joint Chiefs, as well as Admiral Lisa Franchetti, the first black woman to serve as chief of naval operations. On social media, Trump thanked the four-star fighter pilot for his service and nominated Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Kane for the job. It's a highly unusual move. Joint Chiefs of Staff chairmen traditionally keep their jobs as administrations change, regardless of political party. Trump has long insisted that the military's leadership is too focused on diversity issues and has lost sight of its role as a combat force. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth previously criticized General Brown and said Franchetti was selected for her post because of her gender. Meanwhile, a federal judge has blocked a sweeping executive order from President Trump, ending government support for programs promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion, saying it likely violates free speech rights. Judge Adam Abelson granted the injunction as the suit plays out. Trump signed an executive order on his first day directing federal agencies to terminate all equity-related grants or contracts. And Trump has been in office for a month now, and with a flurry of executive actions and orders, he's working to remake the federal government. Thousands of federal workers have been laid off and funding cuts to numerous agencies. This is federal workers' unions and attorneys general from around this country go to court to try to stop the measures. Now NPR's Domenico Montanaro reports a new poll out this week shows Trump's support may be waning.
The bottom line is that it looks like that the honeymoon for Trump appears to be over. The country has largely always been split on Trump, slight majority disapproving, and that's what we saw in back-to-back polls with CNN and Washington Post Ipsos. People were split on Trump's approach to immigration, but both polls found a majority think that he's exceeding his power as president. CNN's poll also found that 62% think that he hasn't done enough to reduce the price of goods.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro. In Los Angeles, the country's new district attorney says he opposes a new trial for the Menendez brothers, accused of brutally killing their parents in 1989. Steve Futterman has more.
In his first comments on the case, Los Angeles County District Attorney Nathan Hochman presented a much less sympathetic view of the brothers than his predecessor. The brothers claim there is new evidence to show that they were sexually abused by their father, Jose, which they say led to the killings. Hochman at a news conference says even if that's true, it does not justify the murders.
Sexual abuse in this situation, while it may have been a motivation, does not constitute self-defense.
A hearing is set for next month where a judge will consider whether to reduce the brothers' life in prison without parole sentence.
Steve Futterman reporting from Los Angeles. You're listening to NPR News. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has held a video call with a senior Chinese official this week. The two countries are once again in a trade standoff after the U.S. imposed a 10% tariff on all Chinese imports. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
China said the call was initiated by the U.S. and China's Vice Premier He Lifeng, who heads U.S.-China trade issues in Beijing, quote, expressed serious concern on the call about what it called, quote, restrictive measures, the 10% tariffs. China's been trying to negotiate with the U.S. to head off the tariffs. Trump is also threatening additional tariffs on medicines, electric vehicles, and steel and aluminum that would also affect China. But only about 2.9% of China's annual economic activity comes from exports to the U.S., and the 10% tariffs are so far lower than the tariffs of up to 25% Trump levied on China during his first term. Plus, China spent the last 5 years trying to proof itself against trade wars and is more prepared in Trump's second term to deal with American tariffs. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
Ford is recalling nearly a quarter million vehicles because of a faulty seatbelt assembly. The automaker says anchors for the seatbelts were improperly secured, meaning an occupant might not be restrained properly in a crash. The recall involves Explorer and Lincoln Aviator SUVs from model years 2020 and 2021. Ford, though, says it's not aware of any accidents or injuries related to the defects. Wall Street sharply lower by the closing bell, the Dow down 748 points. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Not long ago, Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky was being hailed as a modern-day Winston Churchill. Now, President Trump is calling him a dictator. What's more, the U.S. is starting to sound as if it's more closely aligned with Russia. Trump even insinuated that Ukraine was to blame for the war. In short, it has been a wild week. To sort through it all, we are joined by NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez and NPR National Security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hey to both of you.
Hey, Scott.
Hi. Hi, Scott.
Greg, I want to start with you. Can you just catch us up to speed, briefly remind us how this happened so quickly?
Yeah, since Russia carried out its massive invasion of Ukraine, which was 3 years ago this coming Monday, there's really been no full-fledged diplomatic effort to end the war. That changed rather quickly and dramatically when President Trump called Russian leader Vladimir Putin on February 12th, just 9 days ago. This marked the end to a concerted U.S. effort to isolate Putin. It also showed Trump wanted to work through Russia, perhaps even more so than through Ukraine. And this was followed by a U.S. delegation meeting Russian counterparts in Saudi Arabia. And then Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky began exchanging barbs. Trump called Zelensky a dictator. Zelensky said Trump appeared to be living in Russian disinformation space.
Franco, the desire for a deal, are we seeing any movement yet toward any possible agreement?
I mean, it's really tough to say, especially if you listen to, Donald Trump, that is, President Trump. I mean, he hosted a bipartisan group of governors at the White House today where he said he had, quote, very good talks with Putin and, quote, not such good talks with Ukraine. He's also been mocking Kyiv for talking tough but not having any leverage to be tough. And those comments echoed some that Trump delivered even earlier today on Fox Radio, where he basically praised Putin for wanting to make a deal and said that if he wanted to have Ukraine, he could take it all, and therefore responding to criticism from Zelensky about being excluded from the talks with Russia, Trump attacked Zelensky again, saying Zelensky wasn't important enough to be at the meetings.
I mean, Greg, Trump has staked out a number of, shall we say, provocative foreign policy positions. Does his approach to Ukraine appear to be part of this same pattern?
Yes, Scott, it really does in many ways. Trump keeps talking about acquiring territory, Gaza, Greenland, Canada, the Panama Canal. Now, in Ukraine, Trump is calling for the U.S. to get 50% of the valuable minerals in that country, which he views as payment for U.S. military and humanitarian assistance in recent years. Now, Trump made these countries about the other places really out of the blue, and many think these are completely unrealistic notions. notions that really won't go anywhere. It's a little different in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Trump is pushing very hard right now for a ceasefire and the minerals deal, and he recently sent the Treasury Secretary to meet with the Ukrainians.
Franco, tell us more about this supposed mineral deal and how it fits into all of this.
Yeah, Trump's team's been pressing for the deal that would basically give U.S. access to vast amounts of Ukrainian critical minerals. The way the Trump team puts it, at least, is it will be a partnership that ensures greater security for Ukraine going forward as they work toward a peace deal with Russia, because the U.S. would have interests in Ukraine. The Trump team also feels that Ukraine owes U.S. taxpayers some payback for the billions of dollars that the U.S. taxpayer has contributed to the war. But now critics argue that the U.S. is basically trying to fleece Ukraine of its valuable resources and essentially going to cripple the country.
Where do these talks stand?
Well, Zelensky publicly dismissed the deal a little bit ago, enraging Trump and his team, hence the lashing out against Zelensky. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz told us reporters yesterday that Trump was very frustrated about that and about Zelensky walking away from the talks and was pushing to get him back. And that's why we heard all the insults against the president of Zelensky. Now, this morning, Waltz was at CPAC, the conservative political conference, where he signaled some progress and he expected Zelensky to sign. And just a little bit ago, Trump was in the Oval Office also expressing some confidence that Zelensky would eventually sign, because what Trump said is it keeps the U.S. in Ukraine again for security.
I mean, this is a lot of back and forth.
It is a lot of back and forth. I mean, Trump and his team have really left Zelensky very little wiggle room to move. Ukraine is just so dependent on the U.S. for security. And as Greg said earlier, the talks are going through Russia. I mean, Trump is not criticizing Putin in any way similar to how he is with Zelensky. He declined today to call Putin a dictator. He ignored the question when asked directly. And Trump emphasized that he needed to talk to Putin first because Putin was kind of leading the charge and he needed to find out whether Putin would agree to the deal.
And Franco, just to pick up on that, we should stress that Ukrainians do want this war to end. They're exhausted after 3 years of intense fighting. I've been going there on and off over the past 3 years, and you really do notice this. You hear that more and more every time. But the Ukrainians are not prepared to surrender. They want a negotiated solution that protects their interest, and that really means security guarantees from the West and presumably the United States, so that Russia can't attack again.
I mean, Greg, the United States has bankrolled Ukraine's war effort. It has been a close ally in intelligence and military planning and humanitarian on so many fronts. And now suddenly, snap, that all shifts and the United States president is attacking this country. So I'm curious, what does this all mean throughout Europe, where the U.S. has long guaranteed the security of its allies?
Yeah, it's pointing towards just a dramatic shift. And based on these comments that Trump has made, he's just breaking with this fundamental principle of mutual defense between the U.S. and Europe. And this was established with the formation of NATO after World War II. And it's been maintained in a pretty robust form for 80 years now, going on 80 years. Now, the president is signaling to Europe now that their security is their business, that they're way too dependent on the U.S., and this arrangement is going to change. So what we're seeing in Ukraine looks to be not just about Ukraine. It appears to reflect how Trump wants to deal with all of Europe, mm-hmm. which includes many of America's closest allies.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie, along with Franco Ordonez. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Sure thing. One of the biggest remaining opposition parties in Hong Kong is planning to shut down after more than three decades. The leaders of the Hong Kong Democratic Party this week announced their plans to dissolve the party. This move comes after years of political pressure from Beijing that includes a national security law. NPR's Emily Fang has covered Hong Kong and mainland China for the last decade, but she's here in our studios now to give us an update on Hong Kong. Hi, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Tell us more about this party that's in the process of shutting down. What prompted this decision?
Well, they've just been squeezed by a slew of actions from both the Beijing and Hong Kong governments in recent years as part of this broader crackdown on the city's democracy movement. One of those actions was back in 2021, when Hong Kong passed a law that ensured only candidates they deemed as pro-Beijing serve in the Legislative Council or be local councillors And this effectively barred the Democratic Party from meaningful participation in Hong Kong politics, even though it's one of the largest opposition parties. And then you mentioned the national security law, which was suddenly implemented in 2020. That effectively banned any political activity that's seen by Beijing authorities as endangering national security, with up to life in prison if you're found guilty. That law has ensnared some of Hong Kong's most influential political figures, such as Jimmy Lai. He's been imprisoned for publishing and his democratic organizing work under that law.
Now, what is the latest with Lai? We know that his paper, Apple Daily, was closed about 4 years ago, and you've been reporting on his arrest and his trial for some time now.
Right. Lai is this billionaire textile and fashion mogul, but he's spent the last decades funding pro-democratic publications like his own newspaper, Apple Daily, and also supporting pro-democracy demonstrators. Beijing sees him as a traitor, though, and under the national security law, he was one of dozens of activists and opposition figures who were arrested, and he's still waiting for his verdict in that case. He spent nearly 4 years waiting in prison on multiple charges, and then finally, last November, he started giving his own oral testimony for the first time in the national security trial. And that testimony, by the way, is still going on. This week, he was grilled by a national security court in Hong Kong over two articles he wrote years ago in his paper, which has now been closed. And in one article from 2020, he warned that Hong Kongers would, quote, return to slaves living at the mercy of Emperor Xi Jinping, that's China's leader, something the court said could have, quote, incited public hatred. And while all of this is happening in Hong Kong, in the U.S., where we are, the Trump administration has frozen foreign assistance funding this month, and that's hit Hong Kong rights groups based here in the U.S. pretty hard.
Right. The context here is that the Trump administration has been trying to slash the federal budget and has frozen a lot of foreign aid, including by trying to shut down USAID. Which Hong Kong-focused groups have been affected by this effort by the Trump administration?
Rights groups, labor rights groups, human rights research organizations, they got funding from the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Aid Agency, USAID, and this trio of these U.S. government agencies supported this ecosystem of often China-focused and Hong Kong-focused civil rights groups here in the U.S. The administration says they're wasteful, but the timing of these cuts are pretty crucial. These organizations are running into big financial troubles now, furloughing employees, pausing programs, at a time when China is competing with the U.S. in this space. And as my reporting this week found on this topic, found that while the U.S. is slashing its support for China-based advocacy groups, Beijing has been quietly working to replace some of that U.S. funding and influence.
A lot at stake here. That's NPR's Emily Fang. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Adrian.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This week aboard Air Force One, President Trump reiterated his goal of the U.S. buying Greenland, an autonomous territory of Denmark. The statements have surprised and shocked many around the world. Here's what Trump said last month when asked whether he would rule out the use of military or economic coercion to take control.
I can't assure you. You're talking about Panama and Greenland. No, I can't assure you on either of those two.
Earlier this week, Denmark announced another increase in defense spending as Copenhagen faces more pressure over Greenland security. Our co-host Juana Summers has been reporting from Greenland. She spoke with two men with diverging perspectives on a recent visit from President Trump's son, Don Jr.
Donald Trump Jr. arrived here in Greenland's capital, Nuuk, in early January, days before his father would be sworn into office for a second term. He told reporters at the airport in video posted online, it wasn't an official visit.
Here as tourists, seeing it, looks like an incredible place. We've been talking about going for a while. I was actually supposed to be here last spring, but just really excited to be here. Awesome country. The scenery coming in was just spectacular.
Even so, his father promoted the visit on his Truth Social platform. He wrote in part, I am hearing that the people of Greenland are MAGA. We met up with one Greenlandic man who fits the bill at a small cafe inside Nuuk Center, Greenland's largest mall. His name is Jorgen Bosen.
Don Jr. came here 7th January, and I was the guy who welcomed him and guided him here.
Bosen is a bricklayer and is in his 50s. He was wearing a shirt with the now famous image of Trump with his fist raised after last year's assassination attempt. The shirt says, American Badass. Bosen has been watching U.S. politics for years and started supporting Trump in 2016. He sees Trump as a strong advocate for security and the global economy.
From the first term, I was supporting him here in Greenland. So it was kind of a little bit difficult because people make fun of me and tag me on the Facebook and say, are you an idiot? Are you supporting Trump and everything like that? Because we're a small community.
Recent polling from Danish and Greenlandic news outlets suggests Bosen is an outlier when it comes to Trump. A survey last month found that nearly half of Greenlanders see interest by Trump as a threat, and only 6% support the idea of being a part of the U.S. Bosen says his support for President Trump has made him a target. He even says he's received death threats, but he sees this moment as an opportunity for him and for his country.
The whole world has calling me.
He says the whole world has been calling him. Bosen has been working with an American foreign policy nonprofit that wants to strengthen ties between Greenland and the U.S. He says he would welcome a larger U.S. military presence in Greenland, that it would help protect Greenland and its people. As a Greenlander, what do you make when you hear President Trump suggesting that the United States would like to acquire your country?
You know, he's a businessman, and he always took more higher than what he wants. So you have to also try to understand him, what he wants.
So it's a negotiating tactic?
Yeah, it is.
Even as a Greenlandic citizen, Bosen has fully immersed himself in Trump world. He says he knocked on doors for Trump in Pittsburgh ahead of the U.S. November election. On election night, he was a guest at a watch party in West Palm Beach, Florida. He met Donald Trump Jr. there in November. Soon, he says he got a phone call from Charlie Kirk, founder of the conservative group Turning Point USA.
And he say, hey, this is Charlie Kirk, how are you?
And that call led to his role in Donald Trump Jr.'s January visit.
Suddenly he called me and say, hey, can you help us with planning? Don Jr. is coming to Nuuk, can you do that for us to help us what he can do here in Nuuk? So I say, yeah, of course I can do that. Yeah, I welcome him out of the plane and say to him, here, welcome to Greenland.
Jorgen Bosen welcomed Donald Trump Jr. on his trip to Nuuk, where he stayed for a few hours in January. Another Greenlander we spoke to never met Don Jr., but took a different view on his visit and on his father's ambitions.
The whole Arctic is in pain.
That's Akalu Kalinga. He was until recently the president of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, which represents Inuit people of Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and an autonomous area of Russia.
We met him at his home, which overlooks the Nuuk Fjord, and as we talked, he was repeatedly pointing to this big, round map of the Arctic that he'd spread out across his kitchen table. He said, it's not just the Arctic. The whole world is in pain. He compared it to living during the time of the Emperor Nero, who watched his Rome burned.
I cannot understand how a democracy could breed the kind of power grabbing that we are seeing here. So attitude toward Americans right after Trump Jr.'s crazy trip to Nuuk, what the heck is going on?
Linga has been involved in politics in Greenland for decades. He was elected to Greenland's parliament in the early 1980s. He spent years fighting for Greenland's right to self-determination and founded one of Greenland's leading political parties.
The worst thing was that after he was touring around here in Nuuk and playing with his phone, and then came his father in a speech again outlining that he will not rule out a military intervention. For what? Who? United States is already here. They have their power. If there's any problem, why don't they talk to us?
At one point, Linga took a long pause.
It's the most uneducated people I've never seen. It's too strong, isn't it?
You tell me.
I'm evil now. I don't want to be evil, but I'm mad.
Trump has insisted that U.S. control of Greenland is necessary for American security, though Denmark's prime minister has said that the island is not for sale. The U.S. already has a military base here, and as Linga alludes to, could expand its operations with approvals from Greenland and Denmark.
This is so ridiculous. That shows that this is a small person speaking, because he's speaking to a small nation. In the end, there will be a confrontation between the NATO allies and United States.
A confrontation between the U.S. and other NATO members over the fate of Greenland. Today, Linga believes that Greenland's future must be tied to Denmark.
We understand, and we have been understanding for the last 50 years. If Greenland secedes from Denmark, it will be taken by the United States. And why would we go? Most of us have only Denmark to go to. So are we going to be thrown out of our homeland? You. We will never surrender to anyone.
For Akaluk Linga, the message is clear. Greenland is not for sale, and he wants the future of his home to be decided by the people who live here. Juana Summers, NPR News, Nuuk, Greenland.
This is NPR News.
The new documentary, Becoming Led Zeppelin, features early concert footage, a rocking soundtrack, and rare sit-down interviews with the three surviving members of the band. We talked to the husband and wife duo behind the film that captures Led Zeppelin's rise to the top. I'm Don Gagne. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Comedian Ronny Chang has been riding a wave of success in Netflix special roles in sitcoms and on the big screen.
But he says he's still searching for the perfect joke.
Our colleague Rachel Martin will sit down with him for our weekly wildcard segment.
That's coming up after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Defense Department says it will cut 5,400 probationary workers starting next week while putting a hiring freeze in place at the largest government agency. This comes as the Trump administration seeks to fire thousands of federal workers who have fewer civil service protections. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
We're told the Pentagon has paused the expected firing this week of over 50,000 civilian probationary employees who are on the job for a year or so. The Pentagon will conduct a review to determine whether some of those jobs must be retained for national security purposes. We're told that a small number of probationary jobs already have been eliminated, but again, the bulk of these jobs is going to wait for a review. But clearly, thousands, if not tens of thousands of jobs could be affected.
That's NPR's Tom Bowman. With more than 700,000 civilian workers, the Department of Defense is the government's largest. President Trump and Elon Musk are often spotted together these days as Musk leads an effort to slash government spending. NPR's Tamara Keith reports the Tesla CEO also continues involvement with his many businesses that have government contracts and face federal regulation.
As a special government employee, a temporary role, Musk is not required to divest from his companies, but he still has to follow laws barring conflicts of interest. Columbia law professor Richard Brefault specializes in government ethics.
He's basically a walking conflict of interest.
Even the appearance of such conflicts can be a problem, says Don Fox, who used to lead the Office of Government Ethics.
The thing that the public should be concerned about is, well, we don't know. Is he looking after our interests as taxpayers and citizens, or is he looking after his own business interests?
Trump and Musk insist the billionaire businessman will recuse himself when necessary. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
At a town hall in suburban Atlanta last night, Republican Representative Rich McCormick fielded backlash from a large group of constituents who voiced their displeasure with President Trump's approach to government cuts. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Sarah Callis reports.
A raucous crowd of over 500 packed the Roswell City Hall and overflow. Many attendees expressed frustration and anger with President Trump and McCormick's support for him. Trump's use of executive power and Elon Musk's role in the administration were common concerns. McCormick said,
I don't think executive privilege should be as strong as it is. I think we're out of bounds right now. I think your direct representation, whether you like me or not, I'm the closest thing you have to represent.
McCormick, who represents part of Atlanta's northern suburbs, was re-elected last year with over 60% of the vote. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Callis in Roswell, Georgia.
The former leader of the Proud Boys, Enrique Terrio, was arrested today near the Capitol in Washington on assault charges. Police say he assaulted a woman who was protesting at a gathering attended by Terrio and others who received presidential pardons for crimes stemming from the Capitol attacks back in 2021. Terrio was serving a 22-year sentence when President Trump granted him clemency, along with about 1,500 other Capitol rioters. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Here in Washington, senators were up all night for what is known as a vote-o-rama. It is part of the budget process as Republican lawmakers try to implement President Trump's legislative agenda. Here with the latest is NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt. Hey, Barbara.
Hello.
So what was actually in this budget resolution?
Well, it includes $175 billion in funding to secure the southern border and $150 billion in increased military spending. Now, this is a big part of President Trump's agenda. What it does not include, which is sort of the source of a lot of drama on Capitol Hill between the Senate and the House, is extending the tax cuts from the first Trump administration.
Which is really interesting, because they are high on Trump's wish list, getting extension of those tax cuts. So why aren't they on the Senate version?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the House and the Senate have very different ideas about how best to go about implementing Trump's agenda. The House wants to do one big bill that incorporates the border resources, changes to energy policy, and extending the tax cuts all at once. Now, they have their reasons for that. House Speaker Mike Johnson has a fractious conference, and the thinking is it's hard enough to get everyone on board, particularly with a very narrow majority, once, let alone twice.
Right.
But the Senate wants to move quickly. They want to get resources to the border now, they say. So they want to do one bill on the border and military spending and energy policy, and then do a second bill later on this year to address those tax cuts, which actually do expire at the end of the year.
Okay, so Senate, they want two bills. House, they want one bill. Where does President Trump stand?
It's an excellent question. Trump earlier this week said he prefers the House approach. But then yesterday, he thanked the Senate for their efforts right as they were about to start this marathon votorama on their version of the budget resolution. So I think the thinking there is that if the House can't deliver, then this Senate budget resolution can act as sort of a backup.
The House was out this week. Its members are returning next week. So what do they do next?
House Majority Leader Steve Scalise has said that he plans to bring up the House version of the budget resolution to the floor next week. Whether it can pass quickly is another matter altogether. In order to appease members who are concerned about the national debt, House GOP leaders did have to make some earlier adjustments to their resolution that would direct up to $2 trillion in spending cuts. Trump has said that he doesn't want to touch Medicaid as part of that. But analysts say that reaching the levels to offset those cuts without touching Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security is nearly impossible. It's worth noting that on the Senate side of things, last night you did see two Republicans vote alongside Democrats on an amendment that would have blocked tax cuts for the wealthy if any Medicaid funding were to be cut. So there's going to be a lot of conversation around Medicaid next week. And as a reminder, both chambers ultimately have to be on the same page to get this legislation across the finish line.
That is NPR's Barbara Sprunt. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The White House is touting the first month of its immigration crackdown as a big success, but there are still big questions about whether the reality on the ground matches the Trump administration's narrative. Many of those questions have to do with the naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Trump administration says it's now removed all of the Venezuelan migrants who had been detained there. NPR's Joel Rose covers immigration and joins us now. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Adrian.
So what is the latest, Joel? Where are these Venezuelan migrants now?
Lawyers for the Trump administration said in a filing last night that all 178 Venezuelan migrants who were being held at Guantanamo have been removed, and that all but one were on their way, headed back to Venezuela. They were initially flown to Honduras, where the Venezuelan government met them and then flew them on to Venezuela. They landed last night around 10 p.m. local time.
The Trump administration said, Joel, that it was sending the worst of the worst criminal immigrants to Guantanamo. What do we know now about these migrants who have just been returned home?
Yeah, Trump officials have said everyone that they transferred to Guantanamo was a hardened criminal. But we have now learned that is not true. In court filings this week, the administration said that nearly 30% of the detainees who were considered, quote, low threat illegal aliens, unquote. And family and friends of the men detained had also been pushing back against that narrative. What many of the men seem to have in common is that they had tattoos, and some family members think that is why they wound up at Guantanamo. Trump administration officials say these men all had final orders of removal and that many of them were members of Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang that the Trump administration has now designated as a terrorist organization. But it now appears almost a third of them were not.
And Joel, do we know why these men were sent home so abruptly?
No, in a word, but the timing definitely suggests that the administration is trying to head off a lawsuit that was brought by the ACLU and other immigrant advocates, which is questioning whether it is legal to hold immigration detainees in Guantanamo. It's not clear if the administration intends to bring more detainees there or not, but I think we can say that it is very expensive and logistically complicated to put detainees in Guantanamo, especially when many of them had already been in detention during the Biden administration and potentially could have been flown directly from the U.S. to Venezuela now that the country has begun accepting migrants back. So to the administration's critics, it looks like this is all about optics, that these migrants were used essentially as props in a public relations operation to create visuals of migrants arriving in Guantanamo on military planes.
Joel, let's step back a bit. The Trump administration is saying that the president's immigration crackdown has been a huge success so far. But is that lining up with reality, with what we're seeing on the ground?
I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, the administration has been talking a lot about the southern border this week because illegal crossings declined in January to their lowest level in years. Although we should note that crossings already dropped significantly last year under President Biden after reaching record levels earlier in his term. But in other ways, we are seeing some gaps between the narrative that the Trump administration is pushing and the reality on the ground. And one place where I think you see that is with arrests of immigrants without legal status in the interior of the country.
What do the numbers tell us there?
Now, the White House has said that they want to see at least 1,200 arrests per day. But the reality in recent weeks is that ICE has not been able to deliver that many. According to data published by the Department of Homeland Security, ICE has been falling short of those goals. In the first week of February, it was arresting fewer than 600 people a day. And today, we saw the White House shaking up the leadership at ICE and removing the acting director from his post.
Finally, Joel, what do we know about how the public is reacting to the president's immigration policies so far?
NPR and Ipsos have done some polling on this, and we saw that Americans are deeply divided along partisan lines. There is some support for tougher restrictions. For example, President Trump's call for mass deportation of all the immigrants in the U.S. without legal status. We see a plurality of Americans in support of that, 44% in favor to 42% against. But when you dig down into the details of President Trump's plans, the support starts to get smaller. For example, detaining migrants at Guantanamo Bay or allowing immigration authorities to make arrests in schools and churches and hospitals, so-called sensitive locations. Both of those policies were supported by less than 40% of Americans in our poll.
We've been speaking with NPR correspondent Joel Rose. He's covering immigration for us. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Comedian Ronny Chang says he's still in pursuit of the perfect joke. And you can see his latest attempt in his Netflix comedy special, Love to Hate It. Or you can watch him star alongside Jimmy O. Yang in Hulu's Interior Chinatown. The Crazy Rich Asians actor talked to wildcard host Rachel Martin about his journey from law school student to Daily Show correspondent.
What was a disappointing experience that now feels like a blessing?
I couldn't get a job coming out of law school. My grades were too bad, and I couldn't get hired, and everyone around me was getting jobs because I went to a very good law school, so everyone around me was like this very hyper-competitive type A people who were getting really good jobs at these big law firms. And I felt a little left out at the time. But in hindsight, I'm like, oh man, I'm so glad I never got hired, because I think it would have been more difficult for me to quit a job and do comedy. As it was, I didn't have anything to lose, so I could just do comedy. It wasn't like I had to pick between comedy and a corporate job. I never had to make that decision because I never got hired. So
were your parents disappointed that didn't pan out for you?
They weren't, because I never told them.
What do you mean?
I just didn't tell them I was doing comedy. They thought I was studying for the bar exam, which I was, in fairness. But in that time, I was just doing comedy. And by the time they found out, it was almost like too late.
Hey, that's awesome.
That's the secret.
Led this separate life. But you were, I mean, assuming you were in a good enough place that when they found out, they weren't traumatized. You're like, I'm a comedian and I can pay my rent. So it's okay.
Yes. They only found out, honestly, when I got hired on The Daily Show.
What?
Yeah.
But, wow. Yeah. Did they know what The Daily Show was?
No, they didn't know. They didn't know what it was. And then like a couple days later, they Googled it. They found out all about it. They were like, oh, you know, this is an important show. This is a very famous show. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I know. They kind of trained me to be like, it's just an opportunity. It doesn't mean you're good. it just means you have a chance to do something cool, right? Like that's all it was. So that's what I took it for. And that's really what the strength of being on The Daily Show is. Like, more so than fame or whatever, it's like this opportunity to work with extremely talented people and really become better yourself. Because everyone at that show is so good at their jobs that you don't want to be the weakest link, and so you lift your game. So that's really that's why it's the best job in comedy. You know, it just makes you a better writer, performer, comedian, satirist. You know, that show is, it's like the Harvard Business School of comedy.
You can hear more of that conversation with Ronnie Chang on the Wildcard Podcast.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Quote, the education department is a big con job. That is just one of the things President Trump has said about one of the most high-profile departments in the federal government. Trump says he wants to save money and kill policies he doesn't like. Trump and Elon Musk Doge have already started cutting funding, so what does this mean for education in the United States? It's one of the questions we will put to two former education secretaries. John King ran the department during Barack Obama's second term, and Margaret Spellings was education secretary in the George W. Bush administration. They both join me now to talk about what all of this could mean. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let me start here. I would love each of you to tell me what you think the most important role the Department of Education plays. Margaret, I'll start with you.
The Department of Education was founded because we have a shared American belief that education is a great equalizer, and too often kids, their futures were determined by their zip code or a lack of resources. And so we thought, and I think most still do think, that it's a national imperative that we level that playing field, and through various programs in K-12 and in higher ed, work to provide opportunity for all students.
I would agree with Margaret. I'd say the funding that the department provides is crucial. There's the Title I program that helps schools serving low-income students. There's IDEA funding, which is the funding for services for students with disabilities. There's the Pell Grant program that makes higher education accessible for low-income students. And that's the way the government acts on the belief in the role of education that Margaret described.
You know, there's a lot we don't know yet, but the thing that the Trump people are talking about is they want to keep a lot of that critical funding, but perhaps get rid of the department itself, or massively cut down the department, or shift these funding programs to some other department. I'm curious, and John, I'll start with you. How would that change thing if again, the bulk of this money remains, but the apparatus administering it is gone? How much does that worry you?
Well, remember that the department also plays a critical civil rights enforcement role. It's the place where you go if you're experiencing discrimination, whether it's based on race or gender. It's the place that is protecting the rights of students. That would not be easy for another agency to do. And you want the leadership of the department to focus a national conversation on the urgency of good educational outcomes in K-12 and in higher education.
Margaret Spellings, Department of Education money, but no Department of Education. Is that a doable thing in your mind?
Well, I guess it's theoretically doable. I guess things, it makes me want to ask questions like, does that mean then that local school districts and universities and colleges are going to have to interface with a multitude of agencies, whether it's HHS or the Homeland Security or the Department of Justice or the Department of the Treasury, and on and on and on. And I wonder, is that a more efficient way to run things than currently? I mean, what is the problem we're trying to solve? And to the extent that people are frustrated with, you know, the lack of student achievement that we've seen, particularly post-COVID, and what folks perceive as, you know, indoctrination or a woke agenda coming from school districts, then they should take those issues to their local school boards and to their state legislatures, because there are express prohibitions against that from the federal department.
I want to talk about some of those things, and I really want to talk about just the broader state of education. But Margaret Spellings, quick question to you. For a long time, Republicans have criticized the reach, the size of the Department of Education. How different to you is this particular moment, what the Trump administration is calling for, from what we've seen for decades?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's been sort of standard Republican orthodoxy, except for my former boss, George W. Bush. And, you know, is it right for us to calibrate the right role between the feds, the states, and the locals? You bet. And we've been doing that over the many decades, from very minuscule to more muscular, as we've had in the time with more accountability and more attention around student achievement. And that's the other thing that I worry about getting lost on the cutting room floor is transparency around the quality of education for all kids and the accountability muscle that we have through the National Education Report Card and requirements for assessment and reading and math in a disaggregated way.
John King, I want to ask you about another big part of this. We're seeing these executive orders ordering schools to get rid of DEI. What are you most worried about when it comes to these ideological orders coming out of the Trump administration and how it affects education in local school districts?
Well, you worry about confusion. It's very hard to understand what exactly is meant by the phrase DEI when it's used by the current administration. And you see schools doing things that are deeply troubling, removing books from the library about subjects like slavery or the civil rights movement, taking down a poster of Harriet Tubman. You see schools questioning whether or not they can continue to teach African-American history. That is deeply worrisome. We are better off if we are teaching students the whole truth about our history and engaging with the hard parts of our history as well as the wonderful parts.
Another thing I want to put to both of you, and John, I'll start with you. We just got those high-level data back showing that so many students across the country still struggling with basics like reading and math post-COVID. Is there an argument that the current system just isn't working?
Look, we need to do a lot better, and my fear is that this debate about the future of the department is actually distracting from the national conversation we should be having about how we urgently improve outcomes. You know, the NAEP results, the national assessment results, showed that a third of eighth graders are below basic in reading. That means those students are on a path that will lead to not graduating from high school, not being able to get a decent job. We should have our hair on fire about that, and we should be looking to national leaders to talk about what we do next to improve reading and math and high school graduation. Instead, we're just debating whether or not the department should exist.
Margaret Spelling, same question to you. Given how frustrated so many people are across the country with where things are right now, does this help or hurt?
I believe it hurts. Yeah. And, you know, John just mentioned the data. That data is particularly troubling for low-income and special needs students who really have not recovered at all from COVID. Our absenteeism across this country is just shocking and abhorrent. And so, you know, we're taking our eye off the ball when we talk about kind of the administrative niceties of programs that are pretty direct to school districts and to states, and frankly, you know, our block grants that work pretty efficiently while, you know, Rome is burning and we ought to be talking about the future workforce of our country.
It's two former education secretaries, Margaret Spellings and John King. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us.
Thanks.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at cunard.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated...
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a little novelty here for you this evening. We'll have a little argument between the saxophones and the trumpet. Of course, these cats just told me they're going to get away. And the little trumpet just said it's going to do the same. Ain't that right, little trumpet? She said, yes, sir. Oh, that little devil. But before we riff, we're going to chirp a few for you this time. So get your chops together, boys. While we mug lightly, slightly, and politely.
Chinatown, my Chinatown, where the lights are long. Oh, my Chinatown, drifting to and fro.